Drums, please. Hi, it's me, Ashkenazi, your favourite North London Jewish queen. I am here to bring to you the secrets from the Pink Room.
Pink Room, Pink Room, it's the Pink Room, Pink Room, Pink Room, not the Stink Room. Pink Room, Pink Room, it's the Pink Room, Pink Room, Pink Room, with Kenazi.
Hello, my bubblers, it's me, Ashkenazi, reminding you to tip your queens. Welcome to the Pink Room, the queerest backstage since my birth. I am a C-section, so missed out on crucial vaginal bacterium and still sleep in the fetal position. Too much information. This week in the Pink Room, I am joined by my good Judy, Raquel Miel, the lead singer of punk band Dreamwife, Courageous Sagittarius, Silk Manipulator, and Eurovision alumni. Together we discuss the importance of gender to punk, taking a break from social media, and the art of opera. Hitting record with a friend is always a daunting task, but it does give me the chance to ask the questions that maybe we can't ask in standard social situations. And Raquel responded with her usual thoughtfulness and poise. So here it is, Raquel Miel in the Pink Room with me, Ashkenazi.
Here we are at Layla.
Clink. So first of all, let's start with this number that I'm wearing.
You look gorgeous.
This was made by you.
Yeah.
When?
Do you mean what date?
I need to know the date.
Well, about a year ago, I think it was in April last year, it was before gigs were happening properly, and I was in Iceland, because I went to Iceland for the pandemic, where I'm from, and just wanted to make some stage outfits.
And why silk?
Because it's the best material, and also because it breathes, it moves on stage so easily, and... Yeah, and then I decided to add a bit of ostrich feathers because I'm extra in that way.
It is incredibly extra. I feel Mr. DeVille era, like ready for my close-up.
It's exactly what it should be. And it's just kind of a mixture of like 1920s, but also 1990s. So a bit Courtney Love aesthetics mixed with, you know, the feathers of this glamorous era.
It's gorgeous. I feel 100%.
It's also very feminine in a way.
This is true.
Which I thought was quite a fun thing, because my band Dreamwife, a lot of our stage clothes, or my stage clothes for Dreamwife, was really what was available at the time. Because before the pandemic, we were touring so much, and often you didn't necessarily have time to clean your clothes.
Even though you definitely
made sure that you had some cool outfits and, you know, got outfits from friends, etc., and great designers. But there was one year where we did like 155 shows, and I was bored of all my outfits, and they were all sort of TLC kind of style, very baggy trousers with crop tops. That was my style for a while, but that wasn't necessarily representing what I wore outside of Dreamwife. That was just what worked on stage, because also our show is so physical that I didn't really, it just worked, that worked. So I used it, and now I gave away all those clothes because I can't look at them again. Not, they're nice clothes, but it's more like, just worn them a lot.
So silk is your new aesthetic? Would you say?
I've actually been so lucky to have both a mama and a grandma who are obsessed with silk. So a lot of my wardrobe in general has been silk-based, but I didn't take it to the stage.
So when did you make that connection? Because that's one of the things that I find interesting is when you have, you're an artist, but you have maybe a certain aspect of your life that you do in private. And then you make a sudden connection. You're like, holy moly, I should be doing this in my artistry. So like when I decided that I could bring drag and indie together, that was a mind-blowing moment. Mm-hmm. When was that something that happened during the pandemic in Iceland?
Yeah, pretty much. Because, you know, you were dreaming of when you're going to do your job again. When you're going to be part of that musical community that we love again. And for me, I was just envisioning what would I want to wear? What would I want to, what kind of energy do we want to bring?
I feel like Dreamwife is a group that has multiple energies.
Oh yeah, big time.
So we've got three fire signs.
We got three fire signs.
Okay, that's...
We've talked about this before, haven't we?
I think so. And that's a lot of fire. Tell me about the different aesthetics that are coming together now and maybe a little bit about the journey that you've been through and how that has, you know, changed the band or what, you know...
Are you talking about aesthetic journey or...
Aesthetic and personal.
Personal
and
journey?
And is that... being reflected aesthetically as well.
Yeah, from the start, luckily, because we're all fire signs, probably, but we're very much into our own styles and also supporting each other through that. And both Alice and Bella, they don't have the same style as me. But they have so much their own style that they've really looked into and are excited. Bella, they sew as well quite a lot. So a lot of their stage clothes is made by them too. But, you know, a flowy dress is not Bella's and Alice's style, which is fun because the juxtaposition is we're just doing what we feel comfortable in and whatever represents us and our style and what we want to bring on stage, but also we think so much about how can we move in this garment.
Yeah.
Especially Bella is an incredible gymnast and high kicker. And on that stage, holding their bass, they just go everywhere on that stage. And they have to be wearing clothes that, you know, can kick a ceiling. So I think in that way too, I just really like aesthetic... that when people just really embrace their aesthetics, and this outfit that you're wearing now is sort of a part for me in that way in this journey, in a kind of a new era of going back on stage post-pandemic and sort of thinking about how do I want to represent myself in this next era. And sort of the past era was a lot to do with what worked for that time and also when you're overworking yourself.
Yeah.
But also having time to, you know, having a pandemic to think about what you really want to do and having time to sew and try out things and obviously fail because silk is such a difficult material to sew.
So I'm interested in Bella's journey, I suppose, in terms of being in a band, and were they non-binary from the beginning, from when you started, or was that something that transpired over time?
I'm just
interested to... know about their experience going through that, or if that is it something that just seemed natural for them to just move into that space?
Yeah, I think it seemed very natural. I mean, they've sort of just recently been going through this journey, but you know, they've always been non-binary, but it's more about how we want to identify ourselves, so it's exciting.
Yeah, I find it incredible when people are able to bring their whole self to an artistic project. Mm. And I think that's what makes me interested in Dreamwife when I see you perform or hear your music, is that it's very much bringing a whole identity and your whole self. But I think that is kind of where the band started, in that it wasn't actually about the music in a sense. It was like,
no, it was just about having fun with your friends.
Yeah.
It was also towards the end of our education at the University of Brighton. Our very expensive education. Man, England's expensive to study in.
Yep,
but I'm very happy to have dropped that coin to have met Bell and Alice and Paves, our drummer as well.
So that education was worth it for the dream.
It was worth it for this career. So... But we actually started as a way to sort of get away from what was required of us during that final time of uni and the final projects. So this is more of an outlet for us just to be silly, do something that wasn't taken too seriously, saying that, you know, nothing really is serious in art school. But in that kind of way, it was sort of an outlet just to do something random and just to see how much you could push it. And then we weren't actually going to continue. It was just a short amount of time we were going to do this for a few months. But then we picked it back up and moved to London, got a record deal, and have been working as musicians ever since. So not a bad idea.
That's really cool.
But actually with gender, because I was thinking about earlier when we were talking about Bella, there's one thing. I write the lyrics in our band, which is, you know, for three fire signs, it's a bit of a heavy role. But everyone has, you know, their sector, including outside of the music. We all sort of have our own roles. Like Bella, for example, does most of our artwork, our merch. Alice is producing our new album and records and does the demos, and I do social media. So everyone has their roles within a, you know, it's a company. As you know, being in a band is essentially a company.
Yeah.
But with that, having the role of the lyrics, which I also love to do, and I'm so thankful to be in a group of artists where I can explore lyrics and I can be vulnerable and I can surprise myself in whatever journey you take, whatever story you tell, or, you know, when you're a sponge, and to be able to share that without judgment. And this, I've been in a few bands, and this is the first band where I felt safe to do so. And that's also beauty of fire signs. They're just really supporting you. But with the lyrics, actually up until recently, but none of our lyrics have had he or she in them. So when writing, it was very important to have it open, not really put gender into songs. Like, he did that, she did that. Like, not, you know, it's just not that interesting.
And I'm going to try and put this as how I want, but I feel like I'm still trying to make the connection. But when there's something very punk about not writing that standard he, she, did this, say this, right? And I think that's playing with gender for me is a very punk like experience. And one of the things that scares me about like the way drag is going and the way it has changed is that it's kind of losing some of that punk aesthetic. But that's a whole other topic.
Well, I'm curious. Tell me.
As the capitalist machine takes its claws and dives itself in, you know, it reestablishes maybe some gender norms that just some of the punk aesthetic has been lost, I feel. And that is reflected in the way that drag is represented now, I feel. You have to look a certain way. You have to perform a certain way. And that makes it difficult for some punk drag queens to kind of make their mark.
Or debut.
Yeah, or well, exactly. And I feel like maybe the music industry has a similar problem as well.
Oh yeah.
Where like the machine wants it to do a certain thing. I'm gonna go back to my favorite topic, which is Harry Styles.
Is that your favorite topic?
Yeah. Okay. Just a little bit.
Ooh.
But for me, the punk thing to do would be for him to establish his identity. But the machine says, no, let's keep it
David Bowie-esque.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that worked in the 70s.
Yeah.
But we're 50 years later now.
But then again, you can't force someone to give their identity over. But, you know, it's an ongoing debate in my head.
Yeah.
And that's why I enjoy conversing. Because then I can be like, oh, wait, maybe I think this, but actually, no. So, talking of musical projects, you've been in many musical projects.
Yeah. I come from a family of performance artists, actors, musicians, sculptors, and I've been incredibly blessed to have that as a base in Reykjavik. So it was only normal that I did something like that, or else I would have been the black sheep. My dad, we were having this conversation actually yesterday. He his whole family is, he comes from this family, and he is very artistic himself. And he was a child actor, worked in the theater up until he was 18, and he went to rebel. So he did the thing that would most shock his parents, which would be a mortician assistant.
So isn't a mortician...
So my dad essentially is a former makeup artist.
A mortician is incredibly artistic, in my opinion. Isn't it? I think so.
So that was the way that he could completely shock his actor parents and leave the family trade, which I thought was actually performance art in itself.
I mean, I tried the same with drag. I think it kind of worked out. But then my mom always wanted a daughter. So I just think I'm fulfilling her dreams anyway.
You probably are.
With beard, chin strap. Mm-hmm. Although this is getting me Chad Kroger recently. I'm not sure how I feel about it.
Well, I think it looks great.
Oh, thank you.
It matches your hair.
Well, exactly. Just put a couple of pink bits in.
Hey everybody, I'm Dave Holmes.
And I'm Matt McConkie.
And we are the hosts of Homophilia, the podcast where we talk to awesome LGBTQ+ people about the pop culture that they are consuming and loving and the love lives that they are leading. The conversations that we wish we had had access to when we were growing up. The conversations that we would like to eavesdrop on now. But we have them with the coolest people in the world. Like who, Matt?
Sir Andy Cohen himself.
What?
Michael Patrick King, Tig Notaro, Alan Cumming, Jinx Monsoon, and Ben De La Creme. Countless queens from the Drag Race universe. We're asking all of them about the pop culture milestones that shaped them as queer people, and more importantly, who they're having sex with.
There you go. It's the queer conversation they don't want you to have. We're having it on Homophilia every week on the World of Wonder Network. Tune in.
Listen to Homophilia on the WOW Podcast Network or wherever you listen to podcasts.
In a world full of straight people, aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
But yeah, it's such a blessing to be from a family that fully supports any artistic vision you want to explore. I have three siblings, and we almost like chose our pawn to play. My brother studied ballet and was a dancer. And my sister is a writer, playwright, poet. And my other sister, she is a painter. So, and I got to be the musician. It's quite funny how we just chose different ones.
So we have something in common that I only found.
Do you have siblings?
Well, I have siblings. Both of them do drag as well, but that's an...
What? Both your siblings do drag?
Yeah.
You're in competition?
No, because we all have very different aesthetics. But so my drag, Ashkenazi, is very much based on like my Jewish identity, trying to, I guess, come to terms with the religion and the patriarchy keeping me down and trying to like explore my femininity and learning more about who I am as a person through exploring femininity. My other brother, Ben, he's a lawyer. But his drag name is Judge Grinder.
Oh, that's amazing.
Which you can see where that goes. And then I've got my youngest, Toby, my youngest brother. He works in the drum and bass scene. And the drum and bass scene is notoriously quite masculine. Mm-hmm. Does verge on levels of kind of homophobia as well. So he almost uses his drag to kind of create a different viewpoint and expresses queerness in that scene. So
that's beautiful.
Yeah, it's, I feel like, you know, very proud that I have all these drag daughters, I guess.
That's also very unique.
Yeah.
Wow.
But then I think our sexuality is a genetic element. And then I think we've all used drag to explore our femininity in some way. Because I think that was possibly the best way, having been to like, you know, male-only schools where we all boarded, I think drag was probably the best way for us to be able to explore our femininity. Because we didn't necessarily have female friends and that kind of bond to, it's not measuring up, but, you know, to be able to explore who we were against something else or...
And from an early age as well.
Yeah. So it's interesting to me that all of us, I think, have used drag to that requirement, I guess.
I guess I've used music in that way too. And to explore your own masculinity and also femininity, as we even spoke about this garment, that was me more wanting to present myself in a more feminine way on stage, but I can still tear your head off. So this kind of juxtaposition is something that I really love on stage.
Yeah.
To embrace both parts. Because we essentially are just a mixture of masculinity, femininity, whatever comes our way. And I think it's just so exciting when you put that in our art form.
I think that's why I keep the beard. I don't necessarily, for me, it's not about becoming a woman. It's about playing with gender and exploring gender in that way. But going back to the thing we've got in common, I only learned this actually this morning.
Ooh.
Opera.
How did you learn this?
Urban Outfitters.
Oh, wow. You've done your research.
Well, she do spend a few hours on the internet.
I studied jazz vocals. Mm-hmm. I went to a music institute in Reykjavik before I went to Brighton and studied music and visual arts. And I did one semester in opera because my tutor in jazz had to go away for half a year. And I was really excited about it, but I would love to get back into opera. So I'm definitely going to ask you for recommendations of teachers later on. I loved it. It was also very different leaving a jazz class and leaving an opera class.
Right.
Regarding endorphins.
Okay. I want to hear more.
Leaving a jazz class, because my voice goes really deep and it goes really high, so I can be an alt two and a soprano, which is why I got into music school. But I struggle reading music. Maybe struggle isn't the right word. I just don't want to read music. It's something about reading music just sort of puts me off music.
Was that something that, because for me, I totally get that. And as a kid, when I was, you know, forced in part to learn piano and violin, it was all about reading music and being able to do that. And then as soon as I found like jazz piano, it opened my mind up as to what was possible away from the page in front of you.
Yeah. For me, it's all about melodies, and I have quite a good memory for music, so I would often fake it. I've been in choir since I was a kid, and I would be pretending to read notes, but I would just hear it sung once, and I would repeat it, and that worked really well for me. And my great-grandma, she was a concert pianist for the Philharmonie in Hamburg, one of the first women to do that, and she spoke so much about musical ear before she passed. I was about 10, but I really remember this conversation because she was, you know, very classical and, you know, German in a way. But she very much believed in that the musical ear is such a big part of expressing music. So I wasn't that interested, even though I'd been studying music as a kid. I still fake it.
Yeah, fake it to make it, honey.
But also, if you have that ear, that's what has really been helpful to me in bands, because I can hear something right away and I can do it again and repeat it. But with opera, I definitely needed to read the sheets to hit those notes. But however, when I was leaving an opera session, I'd be so full of endorphins because of where it was hitting, as you know. And it's so much sung from the stomach and just like, and your chest and the outburst. So every time I would be leaving an opera class, I'd just be on, you know, cloud nine. And then jazz is so deep because I'd use my soprano voice in the opera, but I'd use my alto voice in the jazz sessions. And I didn't feel much after those sessions. So how is it for you? Do you get endorphins from opera?
I've replaced therapy with opera. Yes. Like genuinely, like when the pandemic came around, I thought that I had to see, you know, I had this kind of Jewish instinct, which was like, I have to sit opposite my therapist, like Larry David, you know, like there in the moment. How could I do therapy over Zoom? But obviously you can do therapy over Zoom. But in the way that you came to Silk, maybe it's some, I think the pandemic was something about coming back to something that was innate to you. And when I was a kid, I was in a choir. And whenever they needed kids at a show, like an opera show, they would come to us. So I would, you know, be carted off to Manchester to go be a child in Carmen. Or
wow,
yeah, it was
that's huge.
It was amazing. Like it really got me into a space where I really wanted to be part of that theater environment and the people you meet and the team environment as well that's around that, or you know, be at the Royal Opera House or English National Opera. And then hormones hit in and I was like, oh, I've got to be cool, can't do opera.
Oh no.
Yeah, I know, right? So
that's really sad.
It's really sad. Male only boarding schools, don't do it.
I will never do that.
No. Although this is what I struggle with, is like, I enjoy my own self so much, but sometimes I only feel that that has come through years of turmoil. But that, we'll leave that aside for a second.
We all have that.
Yeah. But I came back to opera because it felt innate. It felt the right thing to do. And I found a teacher, and the breathing, the opening up of the body.
Gets you high.
Yeah. Fully.
Endorphins.
Yeah. And after an hour of a lesson, I feel like a different human. Mm-hmm. It's insane. So definitely encourage opera for anyone out there. And don't worry, we're going to the opera soon.
Also breathing techniques. My mom is a yoga teacher, and she loves to sing, but she sometimes goes off the note. And she didn't feel so secure about singing in a choir. And she had just started a choir. This is a few years ago. And she's a woman of many, many trades, but yoga is one of them. And she was starting this choir and she was, you know, a bit timid. Choir, by the way, is huge in Iceland. Yes. Everyone's in a choir. And it's such a big part of getting through those long, cold winters is the endorphins that you get from singing in a choir and the community. And, you know, I've been in a competitive choir since I moved to Iceland age 10. But it was just part of what you did. Like there's workplace choirs, community choirs, school, everything. And my mama was starting this choir about 3 years ago. And she was a bit timid about it. And we were talking and I said, it's so similar to yoga. If you don't feel like you're hitting a note, lie down. Focus on your breath work. Like put your hand over your stomach. Try the note then. And we started doing some breath work together in a yoga tactic. And she hit every note. And then she just thought about it differently. Because singing doesn't come from the head. It doesn't come from our throats. We have to use our whole body. And especially the stomach.
Yeah, the thing I've been learning recently is trying to breathe through my asshole.
Yeah, it's a really important part.
Like, so usually when I'm trying to breathe through my asshole, it's because I'm taking 7 inches, but...
Which is very important.
Very important as well. But trying to breathe through my asshole it's been a whole learning process. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the things I've learned about my body as well, like tensing under my armpits. I don't need to tense under my armpits.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of it is learned behavior.
Yeah. But it was interesting coming back to it as well, because it's like riding a bike as well. A lot of some things remained in place.
So you didn't study opera as a teenager or an adult. Wow. When did you stop?
When my voice broke.
So 13?
Yeah, around then, I think. I think it broke and then I didn't like my voice.
But your opera voice is gorgeous.
but I didn't realize that I could sing in falsetto.
Oh.
And I think there was this whole gendered thing around where the voice should sit and that the man's voice should, you know, not go above a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And exploring my falsetto has been such a great process. And again, for women as well, the idea that their voice has to be in a certain range. And I think it can be very restrictive.
It's something I really play around with my band, Dreamwife, because other bands I've been in, I have been asked to be a soprano. So my voice often was sat in soprano one or soprano two. And I'm pretty good at it. So I had a good time. But at the same time, I wasn't really creating the melodies where I could explore certain depths. And it wasn't until we started Dreamwife that I really wanted to explore my range and characters within. And I think that's such a fun thing too, because also Dreamwife has been really important for all of us involved in the band to push aside perfection. And especially when you are, going to a boys' school or raised within, for me, sort of raised to be a good girl and to, to actually compete within others, which is also why I think, okay, this is going off topic, but still.
Go for it.
So I went to this music institute in Reykjavik. It was really hard to get in. And I was so proud to get in. And I was so hyped to be amongst people that were, really pushing themselves as vocalists. And my class had one guy in it, the group classes we had, because it was mainly solo, but the group classes had one guy and about 15 women. None of these women have become professional musicians, but the guy has, and me. And I just didn't get it. And so much of the classes were them being like, oh, I didn't really hit that note, but I'll try again. Or, yes, I've been rehearsing so much and it sounds exactly like Julie London or exactly like how it should be. And I think so much of, being raised as a good girl is so much about trying to create perfectionism when perfectionism essentially is boring.
Mm.
And isn't interesting and keeps you so much in your box. And that has been, for all of us, is this idea of just pushing aside perfection and exploring. And that was with my voice too. Like doing the whole range, jumping from one note to another, it sounds weird, but it sounds like me. Because that's how I want to sound like. So I think that's such an important part of being an artist is pushing aside perfection. Especially if we're raised that's how we'll get ahead.
A lot of my life post male only boarding school or university was unlearning the amount of perfection that I was supposed to exist in. And it still troubles me to this day, like when I'm watching a video back and I'm like, well, that didn't go so well. Also, I've got that added Jewish element. Religion is, again, one of those things that tries to keep you perfect or behave in a certain way. Just going back to different musical outlets that you've been in, tell me a bit about Eurovision or your experience of that, if you want to.
It was the worst experience of my life. How much digging did you do? What have you done?
Well... The thing was...
I haven't watched it. Do you know what happened?
Oh, I don't know what happened.
Okay, so I was a young kid. I think I was 19, maybe 18. And I got asked to sing a Eurovision song. And I was like, yeah, sure, why not? The money was good. The money was good, especially for a 19-year-old who had, just moved into her first flat. But I was like, sure, I don't mind. I can do it. But I forgot it was basically pre-Eurovision. So in Iceland, it's a whole thing. This is not like England. It's like Sweden. We have,
you know, you apply, then a few songs are chosen. There's a huge budget between everything. And it's like many nights before where you vote for that act. And you get to the next round, and the next round, and the next round. So, you know, it's really hard to compete in Eurovision for Iceland. But anyway, I was like, sure, you know, I'll just do it for the money, really. And I'm just, you know, I'm not really, I'm just a kid. And I was the only one, because a lot of the people that compete in Eurovision in Iceland and in the Nordic countries are like pro Eurovision
right
computers. They know exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they also maybe aren't a part of like the band scene or the indie scene. They're more like in a kind of a different realm,
mm-hmm.
more of a pop realm. They don't necessarily tour outside of Iceland. They play a lot of funerals and a lot of weddings as well, which is great. We all got to make a living.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful, whatever part of music that makes you happy. But they were all pro Eurovision. They'd, you know, competed quite a few times and, you know, they were there, professional, and all of them had in-ears.
Oh, no.
But I had only played, you know, in bands in random pubs. Actually, we don't have pubs in Iceland. Let's say bars. But I was like, oh, I'd love to have monitors on stage because I don't know what, I've never tried in-ears before. But because I was the only one who did not have in-ears, when it was broadcasted live on TV, the monitors weren't plugged in.
Oh, Jesus.
I did not hear myself.
Oh, God.
Imagine that, what that will do to a 19-year-old self-esteem. Yeah. She broke down.
Oh.
No, not on the stage because I'm a professional.
Yeah.
But I had to lower the song just so I could hear the vibration of my vocals.
Oh my goodness.
So I knew that I was singing on live TV. My first experience with live TV.
Yikes.
As like an unknown. Just got into music in like college. So yeah, that was a terrible experience. You found that? I think I did an okay job compared to the fact that I didn't hear myself.
You sound great on it. But I was more bringing it up because I've just, for some reason, like Iceland's Eurovision world seems to as...
It's huge.
It's just, I've just experienced it recently, thanks to you.
It's the event of the year.
Because you put me forward for a few shows with Hattery.
Yeah, which are an incredible band. They actually really change things in the game for Iceland's entry for Eurovision. Because they're a band.
Yeah.
But they're also a theater performance piece. So they've really shaken it up.
So I've never seen a show like theirs. And I've never seen a crowd that is so receptive to everything that they give.
I'm so happy you went on that tour.
It was incredible.
It's a perfect combination.
And I was like, when I saw their Eurovision entry, I was like, well, this is going to be weird. But it genuinely worked. Because what the crowd definitely respected was someone who was giving their artistry and their all. And as long as you were doing that, they were there for it.
Which is what I love. When you see a performer give it their all and just, you know, no excuses, just go for it.
Yeah, because I think when I used to be in a band, I was sat behind the drums and I don't think I was giving my all. Maybe I was scared to. You've been given this space. Do something with it.
And a platform.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But
it takes time to learn that, though.
It really does. But that's also the scary part. I wanted to ask you about... So recently you're taking a break from social media.
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted to ask, without going into details, how do you find dealing with the platform you're given and then how that transpires in the social media world and why at times you find it tricky?
Well, I think, especially during the pandemic, it was, of course, important, but also just felt so meaningless at the same time. Important as in to, you know, connect with your friends in a different country. But I think it's just really healthy for us to step back. And I just finished recording an album. And I really wanted to focus all my energy on that. Because as like as we were saying earlier, like being in a band or an artist, you are a company. There's so many different sides that you have to look at. And especially when you're making something like an album, you have to be quite cautious of what you let in from others and what kind of influences you have, whether they're negative or positive. Especially when you're recording, because when you're writing, you're going through all the emotions and you're taking in all these different things. When you're recording, it's really about like owning in on how do I want to present this? How do I want to feel? How can I have this open so that the listener can take what they want from it? I think it's such an important part. And we, as artists in this modern world, we have to remember that too, to take a bit care of yourself, especially when, you know, hopefully an album will live beyond you. And what did you want to say in that time of your life? Who did you want to connect with?
I find social media like the...
Yes, tell me.
The hardest part of being a performer. I don't know how I can translate what I do there. Like the pictures are fine. Like I get pictures, but I just find it very difficult.
What's the best part of being a performer?
Oh, it's definitely knowing that you've got a crowd in palm of your hand.
Oh yeah, and you sure did on that last run.
But that reminds me of something that you said, is that the gig is, yes, I know I've got the crowd in the palm of my hand, but the gig is something that is co-created. It's not a singular person forcing anything, or the best gigs are co-created. So how has that played into a Dreamwife gig, for example?
Everything. Because, you know, the opposite would be a sound check. The audience is everything. And both you and me, we encourage, you know, safe spaces at our gigs, which can never really be obtained, but at least you can encourage it. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that we are here together and we are here to have a good time and that we are also responsible for each other and that we've taken time out of our lives to experience something together. And that's what I usually say on stage in some form, that it is an honor to be on that stage, but it's also an honor to be experiencing something with a group of people that don't know each other, but maybe will at the end of the gig. Like best compliments I've ever received is I met my best friend at a Dreamwife gig, or, you know, I met my community at a Dreamwife gig, and that's so beautiful. So I think nothing compares to showing the gratitude, and to everyone involved as well, promoters and everyone working the show. You know, it takes a whole lot of people to put together a show, whether it's in front of 50 people or, you know, thousands.
Yeah, they do take a village. I think the one that always brings a tear to my eye is, like, you know, every so often you'll get a message on Instagram, and for me, it will always be something along the lines, oh, my 14-year-old son was in the audience and they were so inspired by your performance and they bought a t-shirt and just wanted to thank you for doing that. And that is what it comes down to, is why I do continue to do what I'm doing, because the daily business side of it is just like any other job, right?
Yeah.
But there is something special about someone, you being able to give over yourself and then being able to take that and use it for their selves.
I think it's such an important thing as a performer to acknowledge that. For example, my grandma is an actress, director and playwright, but very well known for her acting in Iceland. And she really struggled with migraines for a part of her career. And I would ask her, how could you continue on performing with those intense migraines? And she said, well, as soon as you walked on that stage, you clocked it off. Because here we have a full room of people to play to. And I mean, that also is like, you know, I just watched that Elvis Presley movie, and that's actually a really negative thing too. But in a way, it's really beautiful when you, I mean, aside from the migraines, if you don't have a migraine, actually don't perform if you have a migraine, but but basically, I think it's really beautiful when you go on that stage and maybe, you know, maybe you like jabbed your toe on the way there, or maybe you had an argument in the car ride there, and you sort of have to remember right before you step on that stage that you need to leave it on the side. Unless if it's a political statement, but because people are there, we're here to experience, and it's so important to give it your all.
I wholeheartedly agree. One of the, I think the reason why the stage has always been important to me was it was the space where my sexuality, issues with depression, small elements of gender dysphoria, they were all forgotten. I was free to be myself suddenly. It is exactly a space where I can just forget. And I think for an audience as well, if once they walk into a space and if they can be transformed or brought into a world where they don't worry, they're not worrying about, you know,
feel welcome.
Yeah.
It's so important to feel welcome at a performance.
If that happens, then that is the what would you call it?
The sweet spot.
The sweet spot. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Is there anything that you want to tell the world?
Ash looks gorgeous.
I know this already. Another one.
Ash has great hair. I don't know. The world is fun. Yes, music is lovely. Exploring gender or yourself, or, you know, how we see this world through the lens of performance and participation. And there's nothing beats a live show.
What a pleasure to spend time with Raquel. If there's something I'll take away from our conversation, it is the importance of exploring yourself through performance and finding inner peace through artistic endeavors. The Pink Room is a World of Wonder production produced by Michael Pressman and Chris Kearns, with editing by Jesse Caron. Thanks to Pip Roussan, Tati Pozuela and Nina Madley for their support, and Lalo for the use of their studio. I'm Ashkenazi. If you enjoyed The Pink Room, please subscribe, rate, review, and share with your friends. And remember, Queens, what happens on tour definitely gets shared in The Pink Room. Ta-ra for now!